Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, November 20, 2020. 10 people were killed in an intercommunal violence in Jungle Estate.
And then they attacked the place called Kolinyang village within Koruwaik Payam. And then they killed five women and then one child.
And Sudan is experiencing a surge in cases of COVID-19.
3 weeks ago, we registered 200 cases. 2 weeks ago, the number increased to 500. And this week, the number has jumped to 700 positive cases.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Authorities in PG County of Jungle Estate say at least 10 people were killed during intercommunal fighting in the area. The acting commissioner for PG County says groups of armed young men suspected of coming from the neighboring Thangak County attacked Korwai and Kolnyang villages this week, killing people and setting villages on fire. The commissioner says the fighting resumed this morning, forcing residents to flee to the bush for safety. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
John Agany, a lawmaker representing the Korwai area in the Jonglei State Legislative Assembly, says women and children are among the 10 people killed in PG County.
On 17... The families of Angak moved from home, and then they attacked the place called Kolinyang village within Koruwaik Payam, and then they killed five women, and then one child, and then they burned down the village. Yesterday, in 19/11/2020. The attack also the same police in Korwai, police called Apai. Then I think there was a big fighting, which lead to the death of five people again, four men and then one woman.
Speaking by phone from county headquarters in Corfuluz, PG County Acting Commissioner James Biliu says the conflict between the communities of Korwai and their neighbors in Fangak County flared up after an aid worker from Fangak County was killed in Korwai last month. Biliu says Korwai and Kolnyang villagers have fled into the Vuchis as the fighting escalated this morning. Biliu says the situation of the people is terrible. They have shelled the people with the big weapons, including a gun called B-30 or PKM. These are guns that cannot be used either by the civilians or against the civilians. This is why we suspect involvement of the SPLA-IO generals. Because where did the civilian get these big ammunitions they are using to shell the people? Biliu's claims of SPLA-IO troop involvement in the intercommunal clashes could not be independently verified. William Gadjath, military spokesperson for the SPLA-IO, confirms he is aware of the ongoing violence between armed youth from Fangak and PG counties, but denies the SPLA-IO is involved in any way.
The yesterday fighting was fought in 2 kilometers from the center, from the draft. Because the fighting was starting as if it was communal fighting between the civilians of PG and the Panda counties. But when we look into the nature of the fighting, we have seen it's not coming as usual. No, up to now, so the SPLA-IO forces are not involved in this fighting.
Agany says human rights abuses are being committed against innocent women and children in PG County. He pleaded with the national government in Juba to intervene immediately and stop intercommunal clashes in the area.
I urge the government to talk to the leaders of HIO who are controlling that area We stop that fighting, because that fighting, there's nothing in it. Because we cannot kill our children and our women without any reason.
Johnson Kwol, the former SPLA-IO governor of the now defunct Van Gogh estate, also confirms ongoing fighting in PG.
It's an incident between the youth of Greater PG and Greater Van Gogh. I mean, the Van Gogh County and PG County. That incident or that fighting, of course, it has escalated to the fighting. It was an incident in the first place, and it's followed by rebellion, and now it has actually escalated to these armed youth fighting each other.
In May, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights condemned what she called a wave of intercommunal violence in South Sudan. Michelle Bushlet called intercommunal clashes, which led to the killings of 8 workers in the area, appalling and said they must end. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng in Bor.
Sudanese health authorities say the country has witnessed a surge in new cases of COVID-19 over the past few weeks. Sudanese acting minister of health, who recovered last week from COVID-19, appeals to Sudanese to continue following World Health Organization guidelines to avoid contracting the disease. Officials at the Ministry of Education have postponed the reopening of schools for 2 more weeks due to an increase in new cases of COVID-19. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Speaking at a press briefing in Khartoum last night, Acting Health Minister Osama Ahmed Abdulrahim, who tested positive for the virus 10 days ago, said Sudanese should strictly observe all health directives so as to avoid contracting the disease. He describes the increase in the new infections over the past few weeks as terrifying.
3 weeks ago, we registered 200 cases. 2 weeks ago, the number increased to 500. And this week, the number has jumped to 700 positive cases. So new positive cases keep on increasing, and this is not a good indication.
Abdulrahim says nearly 100 deaths have been recorded in the isolation centers alone over the past month. Abdulrahim went into self-isolation when he tested positive. Late last week, Sudanese acting finance minister Hiba Ahmed also tested positive for COVID-19. She is still carrying out most of her office duties from home. Abdulrahim says the Ministry of Health is monitoring the situation and is still weighing whether or not to call for a total lockdown.
We shall be monitoring the health situation more closely, and up to this point, there's no decision about a total lockdown. But this will depend on the epidemic's curve. We will keep updating the public regularly.
At the same briefing, Undersecretary of the Ministry of Education, Tamadur Tarifi, announced the government is postponing the reopening of schools for another 2 weeks in accordance with the directives from the Ministry of Health. Al-Tarifi says education officials will decide at the end of that period whether schools should be reopened.
These 15 days will be under close monitoring by the Ministry of Health. If they decided that schools should not open, we don't have much to do rather than following their directives. Our wish is that we begin the new academic soon and should be safer for our students.
Schools across Sudan were shut down in March and were expected to reopen this coming Sunday. Primary and secondary school candidates resumed classes early last month on condition that they observe all health directives, such as wearing face masks in school and observe social distancing. Al-Tarifi says class sizes should be reduced.
The congested classrooms should be divided into two, or else each school can decide to have 2 shifts so that we observe the social distancing. The ministry will be providing sanitizers, and we will also have a regular field visit to all schools to see their response in following up all health directives.
Minister Abdulrahim is calling on all public and private sectors to continue wearing face masks and keep social distancing at their respective institutions. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit.
We move to Uganda, where journalists say they have come under attack from both civilians and authorities while trying to cover political rallies of opposition MP Robert Chagulani, known as Bobi Wine. Sami Sadin is a photojournalist in Uganda. She says she and her colleagues were attacked on Wednesday. From Jinja, Uganda, she explains what happened to VOA's Jason Patenkin.
Sumi, thank you so much for speaking with us. Can you first explain what exactly happened Wednesday when you were out trying to cover Bobi Wine's rallies?
So as we were trying to cover Bobi Wine's rallies, we obviously chased the rally and then got onto a roadblock made by civilians and police as well. It was just all a bit of a mess. And then as we got there, as we got to the roadblock closer with the car, we had some guys throwing stones, like big rocks, at us. So we had to do a little U-turn and just drive fast and just kind of get away from that. They were still throwing rocks at the car, and we were really scared that they were going to smash the windscreen. But luckily, we did get away.
And was your vehicle marked as media? Was it clear that you were journalists inside the car?
We did have clearly a media tag in front of the car, which is also tagged as COVID-19 media, which means we should be able to do our work as media during this pandemic.
Now, these were civilians who were throwing these rocks. Did police intervene at all to stop them?
So the roadblock that we faced were just done by civilians. Police had left by then because I think by then they were chasing Bobi Wine. So the roadblock that we encountered was made by civilians, and throughout the day, on our way back to the main town, which is Jinja, there was a lot of civilian roadblocks, which is just stones across the road. And it was civilians that would tell you, yes, are you coming through or not? But just to put this clear, this was the first time that I've had problems with civilians. Normally it is police that is the one that are interrupting our job. So this is the first encounter I've had with civilians themselves having a problem with journalists. So yeah, that was quite a shock for all of us in the car.
This isn't the first attack on media in Uganda in recent weeks. What are some of the other incidents that have taken place?
Over the past 3 weeks, let's say, journalists have been specifically targeted by authorities. We had a case of a videographer that was shot just below the eye with a rubber bullet. Myself and another journalist have been targeted as CIA spies on social media by the UPDF, which is the Ugandan military. They've put our photos up on Twitter and called us CIA spies. Also, a lot of journalists, a few journalists, especially the ones that were covering Bobi Wine, they were actually dragged out of their car by police. Lots of other occasions we've had that we have to get on the ground with our hands up when it's just journalists, not even protesters or Bobi Wine people or whatever. And you have SFC, which is the security forces, and police tear gassing us straight away and pepper spraying us as journalists.
And have the Ugandan authorities explained why they're doing this?
Ugandan authorities haven't really owned up to the fact that they're targeting journalists. When we went back to the prison where Bobi Wine was being held, reportedly, one of the main guys from the prison came out and told us, we don't want to fight you, but we will if you stay around, basically saying you're not safe as a journalist and we're going to mess you up if you stay. As an association for Foreign Correspondents Association of Uganda, we have sent out letters, especially in the beginning of this week, condemning all the attacks on journalists, both local and international. We haven't had any response from any authorities. So that's really been an issue. So it hasn't really been addressed. So basically, the targeting towards journalists has not been addressed. And the UPDF-linked people on Twitter and social media especially have been personally targeting both international and local journalists throughout the last 3 weeks.
That's Sami Sadini, a Ugandan photojournalist, speaking with my colleague Jason Patenkin from Uganda. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, Ugandan authorities have released opposition leader Bobi Wine. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how would you start a conversation on a sensitive topic or issue.
First of all, you need to know the context, and you need to know what you are going to talk about and why they have brought it in that particular time. Okay. And from there, you make maybe after the introduction, you build the main body and you conclude.
You first need to put out the key things which you want to talk about, which can even capture the interest of the people. Because if you start with something which people doesn't have interest in, they will not give you time to give up what you want to tell them.
You have to know about the issue, and you have to know how to approach the issue. You have to even know how to tackle the issue, and you even have to study on how to speak on the issue to avoid conflict.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Modou. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Authorities in Uganda have released opposition leader Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as Bobi Wine, after he was arrested on Wednesday for breaking COVID-19 restrictions by holding a large rally. Police in Uganda say 16 people have been killed and 45 others injured in protests that followed the arrest of the opposition presidential candidate.
The Ugandan court charged Robert Kyagulanyi, known by his stage name Bobi Wine, with actions likely to spread COVID-19 for holding mass rallies. The Iganga District Court ordered his release until the case resumes in December. The Secretary General of Wine's National Unity Platform Party, David Rubongoya, watched the proceedings.
Bobi has been released on bail, and we are here at the court waiting for him to leave the court and probably head home. There's a lot of security deployment. We don't know what happened, but he's free.
Police arrested Wine Wednesday while he was campaigning in eastern Uganda for January's presidential election. His arrest sparked protests by supporters across the country, leading to hundreds of arrests and a rising death toll in clashes with security. Uganda police pathologist Moses Weruhanga says most of the dead had gunshot wounds.
We had cases of traumatic injuries, accidents, we had the firearm injuries. As of today, total number is 37. 4 female, 33 male.
Uganda's security minister and a police spokesman say the protesters were violent, targeted government supporters, and were believed to be armed. Critics note Ugandan police and plain-clothed security were quick to use live ammunition against the protesters. Human Rights Watch said Friday that Wine's arrest shows Ugandan authorities are using COVID-19 as an excuse to clamp down on the opposition ahead of January's election. Human Rights Watch Africa researcher Oriem Nyoko says the ruling National Resistance Movement, NRM party's campaigns also attract large crowds, which security forces have allowed.
It's a pretext. They've just used it as an excuse to clamp down and violate rights, particularly now in this case on the opposition. Otherwise, we would see, you know, a balance of the implementation of those regulations. We're not seeing arrests at NRM processions.
At a campaign rally Thursday, President Yoweri Museveni said the protesters are being used by outsiders who are against Uganda's stability and independence. Museveni, who has been in power for 34 years, did not elaborate and offered no evidence. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
A court in Malawi has freed a self-proclaimed prophet wanted in South Africa for theft, money laundering, and fraud. The court released Shepherd Bushiri and his wife, calling their Wednesday arrest illegal because it did not pass through the Ministry of Homeland Security. As Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, the release risks soaring relations with South Africa.
Malawian police arrested Bushiri and his wife Mary on Wednesday in the capital, Lilongwe, in response to an arrest warrant issued by the International Police Organization, Interpol, in South Africa. The Bushiris and two others are charged with stealing $6.6 million through theft, money laundering, and fraud. They also absconded on bail conditions, which restricted them from traveling outside the country. During a bail application hearing Thursday in Lilongwe, state lawyer Steve Kayuni said the couple should remain in custody for 30 days as Malawi's government awaits a formal extradition request from South African government. But defense lawyer Wapona Kita said Bushiri's arrest was illegal because authorities did not follow a procedure which requires a warrant of arrest to pass through the Minister of Homeland Security before police can execute an arrest. Chief Resident Magistrate Viva Nyimba agreed with Ikita's argument and freed the couple without conditions. Bushiri spoke with reporters outside the court.
This is not the victory of me. It's not the victory of my lawyers. It's the victory of God.
Oh, yes,
may all the glory and praise go to God. We believe justice is about to prevail.
Ronald Lamola is the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services in South Africa. He told a South African TV station Thursday that he had no problem with the Bushiri's release if Malawi flouted its internal procedures for handling Interpol arrest warrants. But he added that South Africa will send a formal extradition request to Malawi in 2 weeks to have the Bushiris extradited. In the meantime, the South African court has seized Bushiri's residence for violating his bail conditions. Bushiri says he is not worried, saying his life is more important than his assets. He earlier said he fled to Malawi because some people wanted to kill him in South Africa. He did not say why. However, analysts fear Bushiri's release risks souring relations with South Africa if not handled properly. Vincent Kondowe is former political science lecturer at Catholic University in Malawi.
This is the beginning of that criminal process leading to the extradition of Prophet Shepherd Bushiri. So for me, this should be based on application of the applicable laws in Malawi to how to treat a fugitive.
In the meantime, the state lawyers say they will appeal against the couple's unconditional release. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
From Malawi, we move to U.S., where President Trump continues to refuse to publicly concede defeat in the November 3rd presidential elections as Democrats press an administration official for an immediate briefing to why she has not launched a transition process for President-elect Joe Biden. In a letter to General Services Administration head Emily Murphy, Democratic lawyers say her refusal to begin transition activities as required by law is having grave effects that hamper the incoming administration ability to respond to the coronavirus pandemic and endangering national security. Murphy has yet to certify Biden as the winner of the presidential election, stalling the process of officially launching transition. Minneapolis-based attorney Jack Rice, who worked for the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency during 9/11, talks to International Edition's Lori Lodin about what legal options the president has left.
It's unlikely at best. What we have seen from the courts, specifically in Pennsylvania, is that you can make an allegation, but how do you then take one allegation or 10 allegations and say, so let's reject 650,000 votes? And that's something that we're seeing courts simply reject outright. So as a result, even if you look at the claims that are being made, they don't add up. The numbers simply don't add up. The president has the right to do it. And so technically, if you look at how the laws have been drafted, specifically when it comes to certification for each state, but also the Presidential Transition Act of 1963, it allows the president to fight. And at this point, he continues to do so.
And what about President-elect Joe Biden? What sorts of legal action does he have? So far, he hasn't taken any. And he said on Thursday that it's just something that would take up a lot of time. And he's continuing to work with his transition the best he can without any cooperation. But does he have any legal options at this point to get them to cooperate?
Not really. I mean, if we look at the dates, what we know is this, is that states are required to certify by December 8th. And so if we look at what happens once that's determined, is that the General Services Administration, again, a Republican who was appointed by the president who's making the call right now, then has to take those numbers and make a decision. But if you look at the way the law is drafted, it's not even clear what the policies are. So technically, the GSA could actually drag their feet and slow that process even further, which, by the way, makes it very, very difficult sometimes. Because ultimately, what you have here is you have a transition of one government to the next. And the shorter period of time that you have to do that, the more problems you can have in the short term and even long term.
That leads right to the bigger issue, perception here, but also abroad about democracy. The world looks at the U.S. for free and fair elections. That's at the heart of making this country a democracy. How much damage could it potentially do to perception of the U.S. around the world and also potentially make it more vulnerable?
So I think we look at it two ways. If you think about this idea of a clean transition from government to government over two plus centuries, the United States wanted to see themselves with a sort of an American exceptionalist, like that they can do this even when others can't. I think what this highlights is that other countries have struggled with this issue, and what we're finding is that the United States is struggling with it too. And so this has absolutely happened. Now, to your second question, though, could this be a problem for the U.S.? There was no question about it. You can go back to 2000 and what happened between Vice President Gore and George Bush, the son, and you look at that problem. What we found even then, and they talked about this in the 9/11 investigations, that because of the failure of a clean transition, it slowed the ability of the U.S. government to respond to certain kinds of things, which made the U.S. more susceptible to a terrorist attack. So this is something we absolutely have, we've already looked at, and does it put us in that place again? Well, 2000 says it does.
That's Jack Rice, who worked for the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency during 9/11. He was speaking to International Edition's Lori Lodin about what legal options the president has left. That's all we prepared for you this Friday. We now leave you with some classic music from Uganda. We've been listening to some classic music from Uganda. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you must leave your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Get us a good